Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. Craig Venter is one of the most pioneering and controversial characters in the world of science. In June 2000, his company won the race to sequence the human genome, helping to unlock many of the secrets of the DNA code that formed the building blocks of life itself. But what makes a maverick like Venter really tick? The Guardian's Ed Pilkington met him to find out.
I wanted to begin with your own genome, because it's one of the big things that are happening.
Yep.
Simultaneously to the publication of the book.
Yeah.
And it kind of throws up lots of interesting autobiographical questions which are pertinent to the book. But, so my first question is really, you mention, I think in an article, an interview I've read with you, that once people can overcome their irrational fear of their own individual genome, it's going to open lots of doors. Did you have any irrational fear, or have you had any irrational fear yourself? Or is it something you've been totally cool about from the very beginning?
It's something I've been pretty comfortable with from the beginning on. I mean, everybody worries that, you know, we might be really missing the boat and misinterpreting it, but my life has ended up being a lot more exposed than I ever thought it would be. I've said many times, and I totally feel that, I'm more nervous about my autobiography being published than my genome. It contains much more personal information and thoughts versus, you know, probabilities and statistics from a genetic code.
Except
I'm worried about some distant time in the future, you know, as we get really good at interpreting the
right.
genetic code, that there will be much more that is, that people will be able to connect doing research in the future to all the other information and things about me. Am I nervous about that? No, I think it's more just you know, I hope some things don't get trivialized in the future. You know, when it was worked out that Abe Lincoln maybe had Marfan's, people tried to explain his whole life in terms of that disease, which is, I think, a mistake. But
right.
I think having the whole bits of information, it's not going to be so worrisome.
Except the difference between a genome and an autobiography is that the genome, potentially, as you say, things are at a primitive stage still, but potentially lets you see into the future. And, you know, one of the great themes of all the classics is how knowing too much about your future can drive you mad,
yeah.
Which is a great sort of classical theme of literature and so on. And there was no sort of doubts in your mind about you. I mean, it's possible you could have found out things in your genome that you didn't want to know, even at this primitive level.
Nobody wants to know risk for not such great things, you know. The fact that I have any risk genetically for Alzheimer's is not great news. You know, the fact that there's any risk for, you know, blindness, you know, none of these things are great pieces of news. But the reality, every one of us is going to have dozens and dozens of these, right?
Right.
And so what we have to learn is how it manifests. You read the stuff in there, my early exposure to Gordon Lish and J.D. Salinger, you know, it's sort of, what was it, a perfect day for banana fish, you know, being able to predict and know the exact day you're going to die. I'm not sure that's such a horrible thing. I mean, it's part of what I've argued is that if people really knew that this is our finite time, this is our existence between the beginning and whenever we die, that's our time to make a contribution.
So you feel you could cope with that information? Obviously, you don't have it, and
yeah,
you won't have it for many years, but if it does ever become possible, you could cope with that.
I would like to know it, actually.
You would actually actively like to know that?
Yeah. I may not tell my family if I know. It depends what the news is, right? but I would like to know that. You know, genetics give us odds, right? You want to find a way to beat the odds. You know, the genetic code will never tell us, you know, I don't care when it is in the future, it won't tell us the day or the year that we're going to die. It will tell us that we have bigger risk for certain things. In fact, knowing of those risks, what I like is it gives me the ability to do something about it.
Right. So let's run through some of those things.
Okay.
I mean, you mentioned a few in your book, and maybe there's the more that you haven't written in the book. The obvious one is the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking statins.
Yes.
And you're exercising, and you've got a diet.
You know, that's one of the ideals, is as we get information about our own metabolism, our own lives, that I don't think there'll be customized medicines for us. But there should be customized diets. You know, we are also environmental animals as well as genetic animals, and so a diet that works for me may not work for you. And
you mentioned environmental. In the book, you describe how your genome reveals slight proneness to environmental carcinogens.
Mm-hmm.
So are you doing anything consciously about avoiding certain potential carcinogens?
I don't totally know how to do that. You know, maybe less actual barbecued meat or something. You know, the problem is the there's such a mixed story now about antioxidants. You know, the early actual clinical trials show that there's little or no effect from those. But again, that's what happens when you blend information across a wide range of genotypes. And maybe there's a subgroup where perhaps people that are missing that one gene that detoxifies carcinogens, maybe they would do much better on an antioxidant regime. So the trouble is the science is way too early to do much in a definitive way, but I've certainly tried to eliminate substantial amounts of, you know, refined sugar and, you know, the simple things that, you know, can really lead to diabetes and clear-cut evidence across the board.
Another finding.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, all these things are kind of linked, and some were surprises and some weren't. You know, heart disease was not a surprise.
Because of your father?
Because of a family history. Not only my father, but, you know, his father, you know, I mean, it's really hard, you know, as you go back in generations, I don't know what your own situation is, but it gets, each generation you go back, it's harder to get accurate information because quite often, you know, families and physicians lied even to the patients what they were dying from or had died from, right? So, you know, supposedly my grandfather died from stomach cancer, but in fact, it turns out it may have been complications from alcoholism,
right? Which is another thing on your genome.
So it's a different, you know, different set of stories. Yeah.
In terms of the other things that your genome reveal a slight proneness to, just rattling through them: alcoholism, risk of blindness you mentioned, and dementia. All those areas, as you say, are so poorly understood. There's nothing that you've been able to do bar drinking less. But
I mean, certainly the in orders of concern, you know, late onset dementia is probably, you know, one that would give me the most concern as somebody who is 100% reliant on his brain for every aspect of his existence. Not that others aren't, but, you know, perhaps in my profession more than others. The good news is there's no family history of that. But again, there's two different sides to my family. So my father's side, he died at now younger than I am from sudden cardiac death. He never had a chance to find out if he would get late onset dementia. He has one sibling still alive. It's an aunt that I have that's in Seattle who we just were out there for her 80th birthday party, and there's no hint of dementia there. So, I mean, basically there's just no family history of it.
Right.
And I think this may be one of these things, because it was a heterozygote, it wasn't a homozygote effect, that there are so many things in our genetic code, depending on what we do. You know, obviously, the latest research is people who smoke have a much, much higher chance of late-onset dementia. And so maybe it's one of those things, if, you know, you have a genetic risk and you smoke,
right,
you get these magnified effects.
Is there anything that you can do at this moment?
The good news. The good news is the same statin that works for heart disease. There's increasing evidence that it's just a great. Statins are unknown mechanisms, good anti-inflammatories, and there's hints that they actually prevent or greatly delay Alzheimer's symptoms.
Mm.
So the same, and it's the first truly preventative medicine paradigm drug, right? I mean, you could argue aspirin is, right? If you take an aspirin to keep from, you know, having blood clots, that's a preventative medicine. But statins are clearly in that category.
The other one I found really intriguing was the ADHD part of the genome, and which sort of kind of fits your memories of your childhood about being a quite sort of vivacious, hyperactive kid. And you have a line in the book in which you say, you know, nowadays you'd be on Ritalin.
Yeah.
And actually that opens a thought for me, because you know, come the day when the genomes are common, individual genomes are common and actually better understood than they are now, it is possible that children may be found to have ADHD genetic characteristics. Mm. And there are drugs to treat that to cope with the symptoms. Now, it made me wonder, would you have gone on to do whatever thing you've done if you hadn't been a very hyperactive, slightly troubled, kind of slightly manic kid?
Yeah, no,
maybe there is a danger.
It's a great question. And there's a definite danger. I think there's a danger in too many kids being on Ritalin anyway, but we have this certain regimentation with education system in general that is, you know, my genetic code didn't fit in well with the education system that was designed mainly for rote memorization of things. And perhaps if I was put on Ritalin, I would have done much better in my first 12 years of school and probably been
And you would be an accountant right now.
Yeah, that possibly.
You know?
I don't think I ever would have gone that far.
It's such an interesting place.
That's,
you know,
right. So. Yeah. No, it's, you know, Kay Jameson, I don't know if you've ever read any of her work. She's the psychiatrist at Hopkins that has written about manic depression. She's somebody who suffers from very severe manic depression and has gone back and looked at major creative people in history. Mm. And if, you know, one of the arguments is if you look at the genetic code and you treat manic depression as a disease and you try to eliminate it, do you eliminate creativity? Yeah, I think it would have been a different outcome. Mm. You know, it's you know, one of these conferences I was just at in New York before the Clinton one. You know, they talk about the goal of life and society is achieving happiness. You know, sort of this bland state that we're all supposed to reach. I mean, we should all be on Ritalin if that's the goal, or other drugs. But you know, at the same time, Ritalin can be very effective. So my son probably got a double dose of ADHD.
Right.
And he's probably smarter than I am, but has been much more affected and disabled by it. And when he's on Ritalin, is able to do
right.
far better at organizing his life and doing things. So it's,
right.
I think there are grades of everything where,
right.
Now, I've my parents and teachers, if it was an option that they thought of, they probably would have loved to have me on Ritalin. I was probably a real pain at times.
The sort of non-personal headline from your own personal genome is that you discovered greater human variation than you expected.
Yeah.
Well, that's been found before. Can you tell me
There's
a bit about
been hints of it before, you know, from small sets, but to me, I find that as very comforting news. I think what we had in 2000 and 2001, when we had the first version of the human genomes, is, you know, it looked like we were all perhaps far more clonal than we thought, which created great difficulty in my mind of really explaining human variation. You know, could it, you know, it, would it led to all these people that go around just measuring SNPs? The assumptions were we all had exactly the same set of genes. And all we were looking at was point mutations in those genes. Fortunately, that's not how our biology works. And as an individualist, I certainly like the notion that we're genetically far more individualistic than it looked a few years ago. But you and I could differ as much as 1 to 2%,
right.
Which is...
Which,
you know,
to I'm a lay person, to me it doesn't sound very much.
Well,
to you
compared to 1,000, one out of 1,000 base pairs difference. And so I had a slide that I've used for years. It was based on the collaborative project we did with Svante Paabo in Germany on the chimpanzee genome to human, that the slide said we were 1.27% different between humans and chimps.
Right.
And the way these notions came about, it was sequencing a large number of, you know, random sequences from the chimp and laying them on top of human. So in the places where there's good alignment, it differs by only this tiny amount. But when you take into account all the variants that came out of sequencing my genome, and other scientists have been characterizing on smaller scales, it looks like the difference between human and chimps could be 5 or 6%.
Right.
And that makes us much more comfortable about the 1% to 2% in the human population. But, you know, without any other information, I mean, we differ more as humans than a few years ago we thought we did from chimps. So
right,
it's a big difference in our thinking.
Right. I mean, the slightly disappointing aspect of the findings of the genome in your book is that you don't have any genetic predisposition to risk-taking, which I was very disappointed to read because that's so...
Well, so actually that
runs counter from your life.
Yeah, that got modified. So now, you know, on closer examination, I'm in the moderate risk category.
Uh-huh.
Which makes a lot more, you know... I mean, look, number one, interpreting changes in single genes in terms of complex behavior, to me, is a pretty silly business. So whether there's a correlation or not, I can't get too excited about it either way. Am I an adrenaline junkie? Yes. I mean, you know, from the beginning, I love adrenaline. But at the same time, I'm not one of these extreme guys that has to jump out of an airplane every day.
We'll come on to this. People use different words for it. Maverick, outsider. Extreme is probably the wrong word, but risk-taking is a very good way of summing it up. You've led a very risk-taking life compared with most even of your peers in the business in which you're in. And it makes me, as somebody who just read your book, very curious to know, where does that come from? Yeah. And it's a question we all ask ourselves, why am I like I am?
Yeah.
So you must be curious in a sense about, is there the genetic component there?
Well, yes. In fact, one of the things that, you know, John Brockman, who's my agent, but head of, you know, the edge.org, you know, I think it was last year, there's a question each year that goes out to, you know, his group. And one last year, I think, was, you know, what's your dangerous idea? And the idea that I have that I think is dangerous for society that's going to be tough to cope with is, we're much more genetic animals than we want to acknowledge.
That's interesting, because you've always said the opposite.
Well,
until recently.
I've said the opposite in terms of genetic determinism.
Right.
But you know, people go to this extreme. You know, the notion of the blank slate that you know each child that's born is a blank slate, and their parents sort of fill in, and environment fills in that slate for them. Do you have kids?
Yeah.
Okay. You probably recognize what most parents do is that their kids have unique personalities from day one.
Very, absolutely.
Right? And it only works one way. That has to be genetic. And so it's something everybody sort of knows, but we try to pretend. You know, we have these notions as part of society, we're all created equal. And, you know, as you saw, I tried to deal with that a little bit in the book. You know, when I was 17 and swimming against a 13-year-old Mark Spitz, I found we weren't all created equal, right?
Yeah.
And we see that every day, and it applies to every aspect of things. I mean, so we know from dogs' phase, personality and behavior are clearly very genetic. How genetic remains to be determined. Obviously, environment plays a key role, and I still strongly believe what I always said, that, you know, we're not genetically deterministic species, but we're very genetic.
Right. So in your case,
it
may be that
you're
a very driven
person
always would be very driven.
Right.
Where you ended up would depend on your life experiences.
That's right.
People with my
background end up in jail as often as they do, you know, in the tops of their field.
But are also very driven in whatever area of crime they're involved in.
Yeah.
And one day we'll understand more from your human personal genome.
Right.
Where that.
When you were asking about the risk taking, I mean, I think there's, you know, probably always been a certain element looking back, you know, looking at the racing airplanes kinds of things and stuff like that. But I think that's very different than learning how to take professional risk.
Right.
And I think that entirely came from my experience in Vietnam and, you know, living through it and learning. Fortunately or unfortunately, at a very young age, that the biggest thing you have to risk in life is dying, and dying without having done anything.
Right. I mean, that was going to be my next question in terms of the environmental side of your life.
Yeah.
Vietnam was clearly very seminal year.
Yeah.
And the two episodes that you point to, one was the death of the soldier who had a tiny little bullet wound in his brain, and so tiny and yet sufficient to kill him.
That's
and
right.
It made you want to understand why that could be so.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, it's just even that's, you know, for a society that's raised on, at least the generation I was, things like Dick Tracy cartoons where, you know, he could get 1,000 bullet holes in him and sort of like Swiss cheese and keep on going, that, you know, for a naive mind makes some sense, right? I mean, you know, we have 100 trillion cells. You got to kill a lot of them to kill somebody. In fact, you don't. You just have to kill very few of the right ones, and you kill all 100 trillion. You know, those are very different concepts that are based on, you know, real intimate knowledge of how we work.
And right, and that got you thinking on a sort of precise base level.
Yeah.
But on a wider level, there was the incident of the guy who had a relatively, we're talking Vietnam here, a relatively minor wound, and died just simply because he gave up.
Exactly.
And that, I mean, that's kind of paradoxical for someone who then goes on to spend a lot of their life trying to work out the genetic component of life, because that was all about will, wasn't it? That was about human will overriding.
Yeah, in fact, even in, if you look at what my White House speech, it was, you know, the human spirit is a very key part of determining life outcomes. You know, how much of human spirit is genetic and hormonal versus other things? I mean, it's still, it doesn't matter. It's you know, people with a strong will to live, a positive outlook, clearly can live through and survive things that others would have long given up and died over. And so it's, I mean, you see it in all aspects of life. You know that some people, you know, you just call it, they're clearly survivors, right? You can tell that person's going to survive a different set of adversity. I think I'm a survivor. I could have suffered, you know, at least 100 professional deaths.
And you could have drowned
probably,
in Vietnam.
And
you could have drowned in the what do you call the triangle? The Bermuda Triangle.
I could come up with a list, and I thought about doing it, of, you know, the 100 times I've come closest to death in my life, right? You know, from having pneumonia as a kid to, you know, near car crashes. You know, I mean, there's a lot of times where a second or two different would have a very dramatic outcome, or just a difference in attitude and thinking. So, you know, quick reflexes and you know, being in situations where your own abilities allow you to get out, you know, we don't know those subtleties of how often, you know, people end up getting a Darwin Award for their behavior versus, you know, making major achievements with it, right? Mm.
And I chuckled when I got to the bit where your first work was on adrenaline, because, you know, that's a good metaphor for your life, isn't it? And yet you chose to study the chemistry of
that's
adrenaline.
Right. I contend that people in science, they end up even in fields of science or medicine, that there's a family reason for, you know. And this is probably a horrible generalization that'll get me all kinds of, you know, hate mail from psychiatrists and psychologists, but, you know, it's my experience the ones that go into those fields are ones with, you know, either personal demons or family demons that
they've
seen.
What was the family demon in this case?
Well, in this case, it was not a family demon. It was just, you know, curiosity of the thing that interested most about my life. And
so it was a conscious thing. You wanted to understand why you were so adrenaline-fueled.
Yeah, yeah. And just being fascinated with it of, you know, whether it's really true that one hormone like that can make the difference in, you know, survival or not.
Right. And did you have an inkling at that time when you were doing something that was very, very kind of minuscule, really, in the big scheme of things, that not that many years later it would lead you step by step towards trying to create artificial life?
No.
Not minuscule by any definition.
I had zero concept looking forward at all. I mean, it just sort of, I was, you know, for the first time in my life, I was totally embroiled in learning and, you know, learning about science, learning about information. I was never exposed to any place in my life. It was just one of the most fascinating periods. I worked, you know, fortunately I could train with some of the best scientists in the field that I was in and just got exposed to it. Every day was an adventure. I had no idea where it would go.
Right.
You know, that's why I refer to this one book that I read. So my mentor, Nate Kaplan, worked with Fritz Lippmann, who won the Nobel Prize for the high energy bond. And he wrote this book, Wanderings of a Biochemist, just about how you couldn't tell how you got from here to here because it was such a torturous route. And, you know, I think my life really follows that.
Well, except there's been quite a linear sort of mean running through it, which is you're increasingly drilling down into the most fundamental of questions, which are, you know, now is like, can you create life? You can't get much more fundamental than that.
There was a logic, I hope that came across in the book, that a logic of how I ended up going from one area to another and what those transitions were. I don't think they were predictable transitions.
Right. So there's an element
of chance.
Most
of my colleagues exposed to those same things don't make those transitions.
So what was it about you and your interests that have led you towards the sort of bigger and bigger question?
I mean, number one, that's foremost as learning science. In learning science as an adult after coming back from Vietnam was in a very different mindset and situation than anybody. I was just hungry to learn. And I've argued that science is one of those things can either be the most trivial or most profound things. Anybody can be a scientist by just asking simple questions about things and trying to get real answers, right? I mean, they can be about everyday life. They can be about, I call it evidence-based decision-making. Mm. What I learned from the late Nate Kaplan was, the great scientist is somebody that filters out this 99% crap and can ask the most important questions. And it's always a challenge.
And who dares to ask those questions
and
resist the little niggling doubt in the back of your mind that tells you not to do it.
And sometimes it's not so little. It can be quite major doubts.
I mean, and of the two things that stand out for me most about your trajectory and your work, one is this thing that you do ask the big questions in a way, as you say, other colleagues don't. But the other thing is that the audacity, which is a word the New York Times puts beside you, the audacity of the scale of your ambition. So I was interested in reading in the book that it took pretty much 10 years to decode just one human gene. And at that time, there were assumed to be 100,000 human genes. Mm-hmm. And yet, that wasn't enough to stop you having the ambition to decode all, we thought, 100,000 genes, which at that rate would have taken 100,000 years.
That's right.
And that wasn't enough to put you off. I mean, it would put me off.
Well, because and part of the process is you have to think there's a much better way to do it. And look, in the mid-1980s, I bought into all this stick that was out there that, this was such a massive undertaking, it would take all the governments on the planet and most of the scientists to do this and billions of dollars, right? I mean, I started in thinking, yes, it's really monumental, but I also bought into the notion of how fantastic it would be if we could get that information. And my assumption starting into things is, in the process, you constantly, by examining them, develop much better ways to do things. So I think one of the assumptions all along that many of us had was, we're starting with these very crude tools, but in the process of thinking about it, we'll develop better ways. I never thought it would be the orders of magnitude that we came up with, but I thought it would definitely improve. And my goal early on was just to help drive the process and to be part of it. It evolved into, hey, we can do this better and we can do this ourselves. I mean, but it didn't start out that way.
And we can do it ourselves is the third really important thing about your attitude, which is other people faced with an enormous, daunting challenge seek comfort and protection in an institution.
Yeah.
And they'll surround themselves with bureaucracy and red tape. And it may therefore make it much slower, but it's a much safer, much more comforting process. You've always seemed to have found that distasteful or not for you, you wanted to avoid that.
I view there's several degrees of institutionalization, but they all have something in common, from prison to the military to an academic institution to a government. I mean, they're gradients that they actually have a lot in common of abdicating decision making and authority to others. And I guess if there's a if there's a set of genes I have, it's the test of authority.
Right.
And so I never wanted to necessarily be in a situation where I had to constantly advocate to others. But I was actually quite comfortable in the intramural program at NIH. I was able to, do an awful lot there. It just it became limiting. Let me say that I've never really felt that what I was doing was so audacious or grand.
I mean, just the sheer scale of it. You were seeking to do something that, as I said, at the time people thought would take 100,000 years, and that is audacious.
Yeah.
Simply put.
But I mean, it was the thinking that there are ways to get there. I mean, the other thing, very importantly, that I learned from Nate Kaplan, that very few people provide it for in science, and maybe it's my unique background having good mechanical, spatial skills and things myself, being able to build things and do things, is most scientists are afraid to take on any new technique or new technology. I mean, that's where they need the most hand-holding, and they'll stick to old technologies forever rather than take on something new because it's risky.
Right.
And as you saw in the book, I had officials at NIH even offering me more money not to take on the new technology, right?
Right.
What I learned from Kaplan was, not to be afraid of new technologies, but to sort of embrace them and understand that you have to devote some very serious time totally to getting into them.
Right.
So there are people that bought the early DNA sequencers, they plugged it in and they tried to sequence something with it and it failed and they sent them back. I started with the notion this is probably going to take at least 3 months of my time to really get in and master to make it so that it could really work.
Right.
And so that's just an attitude I start with. So I'm not afraid of the technologies, and in fact, I guess if anything, I've developed a faith in them and the abilities of people with very different skill sets than I have to do extraordinary things with them when challenged.
That was Craig Venter, speaking with The Guardian's Ed Pilkington. Come back next week for another half hour in their company, as Venter talks about his future research in the race to create artificial life.
Yes, I'm always thinking about the larger applications, because if all science provides is interesting information about life, is that important for us as a species? Absolutely.
Mm.
But I view that we are a society that is 100% dependent on science for its future existence. It's not a nicety. It's not, gee, this is great. Let's fill up encyclopedias with information. If we're not using our knowledge to find a way to change things and survive, we will stop surviving sooner or later.
For more interviews like this and the very best analysis of the worlds of science and technology, make sure you listen to our Science Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts.
Guardian Unlimited.